meeting tonight, Central Region. Appreciate you making the sleigh ride and getting here. It wasn't easy for really anybody to get here, so we appreciate your willingness to stick your neck out and make a safer wildlife. As far as process and procedures and stuff go, most of you kind of know how this goes. We encourage you to express your opinions. There's a time and a place to do that. Those of you will want to fill out one of those cards over there on the table for comments. We'll have a presentation by somebody from the division, at which time we will call for questions from the RAC, and they can have it to offer any questions or points of clarification. Then we'll open that up for the audience for the same opportunity of questions or points of clarification, and then we'll bring it back to the RAC for their deliberation and action. Anyway, we'll start tonight. We have an agenda. Have you guys had a chance to look at the agenda? Okay. I'll entertain a motion on...
I'll make a motion that we approve the agenda as presented before us.
Okay. Motion made by Matt, seconded by Sarah. All in favor? So we're not unanimous.
Oh, you can do it anyway.
Okay, yeah. Voting is unanimous. We will have we haven't had a wildlife board meeting since our last RAC meeting, so we don't have a wildlife board update, so we'll go right to the regional update, and we'll turn it over to Dr. John Fairchild.
I'll have to get my dad, who is a dentist, to give this. Okay, going through our various sections and the activities that they've been involved in. In our wildlife section, we're wrapping up our postseason deer classification. Anything to add to that? Seeing more, fewer, larger, smaller?
Looks good. Fawn crop looks
good. We have a new depredation technician in Josie Siemens. He's been working for us for some time, and this is a promotion for him. We have a new wildlife technician. Not sure who it's going to be, but they'll be in Salt Lake, and that'll really help us with some urban deer and other urban wildlife issues that we deal with on a regular basis. We're planning to move turkeys out of Pleasant Grove, Provo, and Sundance subdivisions. And that's in response to the rule that was passed that we have a responsibility to deal with turkeys that are creating a nuisance within city limits and to do it timely. Bear cubs that are rehab rehabilitation center has been tending at our Springville game farm area. Are going to be released sometime next week, John, Thursday. They came in as really small cubs, and this woman ended up having to actually bottle feed them. And now they're, I bet they're 60, 70 pounds easy, or at least. Section personnel and conservation officers received chemical immobilization training that's required for everyone, all division employees who administer drugs to wildlife. Again, that allows us to deal with urban wildlife that need to be moved from within city limits to elsewhere. And then our urban wildlife management plan is nearing completion. In our habitat section, we've got a chaining project that's taking place up Spanish Fork Canyon and Dairy Fork that's still in progress. Had a little bump in the road there, but they're back to work, or soon will be. A one-way chaining and seeding is complete. We just need to get them to go over it the second time to remove the trees and cover the seed. Upland game projects. We have food plots going that have gone in at Car Fork and Fairfield. And they're planned for Nephi and Santaquin WMAs. The Fairfield one, is that on private ground?
It's on a walking access.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Cool.
Patch Springs Fire Rehab, that was the big burn that on the southwest side of the Stansbury Range. We're aerial seeding 10,360 acres in the next couple of weeks, and then a one-way chainings to follow that. Wildlife Management Area winter closures have begun. We generally lock up those winter ranges for to restrict vehicle access from December 1st to April 15th every year, April 30th. And not in all areas, Sand Peak County, we don't. We're going to put some signs up on some of these areas where we have extended cow elk hunts that if people harvest an elk on the unit and need to access it with a vehicle, once it's down, they just contact us. That seemed to be the best way to handle that. Accommodate. You know, we want the elk taken. It's a lot easier to hike in to get to them, but hiking out with them would be a little problematic. So there'll be a number there to call, and they can contact us, and we'll go unlock the gate. Aquatics refuge population, a least chub, was established in a private pond near Fairfield, and that one got quite a bit of publicity. Pretty neat program there. There are only six populations that we have in Utah, and they're the only ones in the world. So anytime we can create a refuge population to give a little more security to that species, then that's all part of a conservation plan that we have with other agencies. Trout in the Classroom is a program that Trout Unlimited promotes, and we're going to begin that in three Salt Lake Valley schools next week. So that'll be... You're probably involved in that.
No, I'm not.
Okay.
They've reported on it every meeting. So.
That'll be fun to follow. And they basically get the eggs from us, and they raise the trout in an aquarium there in their classroom and release them, you know, in one of our community fishing ponds probably is where they're going to go. Recently stocked excess trout in Burriston Ponds, Grantsville Reservoir, Nine Mile Reservoir, and Santaquin. And had some reports back from Burriston that the guy that fishes that every day has really, really enjoyed having some fish in the pond. Summarizing all 2013 aquatic invasive species activities, public contacts from regional waters, that's probably what you're doing. No? Okay. Finalizing update of the strawberry management plan, summarizing creel survey, analyzing age and growth of smallmouth bass at Jordanelle. We're writing proposals for future habitat conservation and angler access projects. And Mike wanted me to mention that the fall fishing is still very good. And it will even be better as soon as the ice, right after the ice is on, fishing gets pretty good for a while. Conservation outreach. Our outreach section has been meeting to discuss implementation of our new wildlife recreation program. That involves shooting sports, mentored hunting and fishing events, hunter education, and any activities that promotes shooting sports or hunting or fishing. So a variety of activities there. In our law enforcement section, our officers are currently involved in conducting winter range patrols to try to curtail poaching on some of our critical mule deer winter ranges. And we do have a new conservation officer intern, Heather Reich, who will be in Wasatch County to help us handle urban wildlife issues. So that's it from the news desk. Phil Gray. We're going to have to skip him. He said he's on his way, but he's going to be late.
All right. Thank you, John. We'll move into the action items that are on our agenda tonight. The first one we'll skip. The individual who's presenting is on his way. And the next one is, I wanted to mention one other thing. As you make comments, if you're speaking for yourself, you have 3 minutes. If you're speaking for an organization or an individual, you have five. And so we'll try and help you keep track of that. But anyway, also, we'd invite you to please comment if you feel inclined. Okay, we have an aquatic invasive species rule and amendment, and that'll be presented by Candace Hutchison. It's our...
Unless you want to go to John.
It doesn't matter. Jordan, about 10 minutes ago, hit Point of the Mountain. So he's still trying.
He's a ways out. What would you like to do?
I can do it.
Why don't you do it and then give him a call to tell him he can turn around and go back? You know?
He still has to go home, so he's going this way.
Oh, is he coming this way anyway?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Then let's hold off. Why don't we go with John?
Or the next...
We have the landowner permit rule.
You want to do that?
Yeah.
Okay, this is R657-431 landowner permit rule, and we'll have the regional biologist talk about it. Kobe.
Kobe. Kobe Jones, I'm the regional wildlife manager. So this is just an amendment to the landowner permit rule for buck bulls and buck pronghorn as well. So right now, the way it is for a landowner association, they have to apply every year.
Now you can hear me. You have to apply every year, go around and get the signatures for every member of the landowner association in order to get the permits. All this change would do is make it so that you only have to apply once every 3 years. So it's very similar to the CWMU process. So even though the registration is every 3 years, it would still allow the division to annually adjust the permits because the permits are based on the percentage of land that's in that species habitat. So if it were deer, if they have 14% of the land of the unit in deer habitat, they would get 14% of the permits, for example. So permits change annually based on buck-doe ratios. We'd still be able to adjust those permits, 14% of whatever the permits were. And that's it.
You're pissing us off.
I don't want you to dwell on this for too long.
You probably understand how you're going to look.
I had an individual ask me a question today regarding this, not specifically that part of the rule, but the landowner permit. And he was down hunting on the ponds, had an archery tag, and he wondered, you know, if people have landowner permits, and so they're given a percentage of the permits from that unit because of the amount of land they own, can they keep everybody else off of it?
Off of their land? Is that the question?
Mm-hmm.
The answer to that is it depends.
Okay, that's...
So in some cases, the rule in that area is not clear, and we'll be doing some clarification on that hopefully this coming year. There are some landowner associations that restrict all public access, and there's a portion of the rule that allows them to do that, to get an exemption. But in most of the landowner associations, the way the rule's written, they're supposed to allow access to an equal number of individuals on private lands, or somewhere thereabouts. Can I say thereabouts at a RAC meeting?
You just did.
Yeah.
If they let somebody on their private land, they have to let somebody with a public tag hunt on their private land. That's kind
of... Is that what you're saying?
That's how it reads.
But yeah.
It's unclear. It's difficult to enforce. Yeah.
That portion of the rule is hard to interpret. And John said, as John said, very difficult to enforce.
Because this guy, they'd been watching some deer, and they were on the public part, and the private was right behind it. And so all of the private guys walked right through the public part and moved them off each day so that they weren't ever there. But he ended up paying a trespass fee so we could hunt on that land. and he wondered how, if they gave him tags and then they were also able to charge him to hunt on that land. He said he didn't, this kind of sticks in his craw, is how he put it. But that's not...
As the rule is written now...
they could do that?
I don't want to speak for the Ponsagon because I don't know what their agreement is. There's a clause in there that says that they don't have to allow access. So some of the units don't allow any.
Okay. All right. Danny.
Yeah, I had one question that I had even last week. So if it lasts for 3 years, then but the numbers of the animals harvested is likely to change on most of those, based upon whatever the formula is based upon. One of the landowners in the association or wherever might not. That might be a straw that broke the camel's back. He might say, "Oh yeah, this is not. It's, you know, the numbers have gone down. It's not worth it for me." But he's kind of stuck in a 3 year time frame, so he can't bail out. Is there a way that he can? You know what I mean? Because you're not securing signatures from everybody at that point, where he would just say, "Hey, I'm not going to sign. That's just not working for me." You know.
So the answer is they qualify for the number of permits they receive based on those signatures at the time. So
if property ownership changes, then
yeah, the percentage of property they own would become less.
They'd all become less, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And at some point, it becomes not worth doing at all because the size of the...
They have to have at least 50%
of the private land in the unit to qualify.
Well, 50% of the landowners... that own the private land have
right,
to
I get
sign
it.
Up.
Yeah, okay.
They don't have to own 50% of the area.
No, not of the area, but it's in it. Yeah.
But you do understand. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Are there any other questions from the RAC about this? From the audience, are there any questions from the audience of points of clarification? All right, seeing none, we'll bring it back to the RAC for... your disposition or approval.
And we do have a quorum.
We do have a quorum.
Yeah. We are too. Justified very nicely.
I'll make a motion that we accept the proposed changes to the landowner permit rule.
Okay. Motion is made by Matt. Seconded by Larry.
Point of order. It just seems like we haven't, you know, I'm not sure we asked the audience if they had any questions, but we didn't ask the audience if they had
comments. That's true.
So, just point of order here.
That's true. Thank you. Are there any questions or any feelings, impressions, instructions from the audience? I apologize. Will you remake your motion, please?
I propose that we accept the changes made to the landowner permit rule as presented.
All right. Motion is made by Matt to accept the changes as presented. Seconded by Larry. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. Our next action item, we'll skip down to number 8 and go R657-10, the Cougar Rule and Amendments. And we have John Shivik, the Mammals Coordinator, that will make this presentation to us.
Did you get hazard pay for coming down today, John?
I should have. It took me 3 hours to get here. Yeah, it was too late, you know. By the time I was halfway, I was stuck. I don't see the presentation here. Is it? Am I just not seeing it?
What's the name of it again?
Oh, it's going to be Cougar.
I don't know. I can't remember the name. I don't know if I got it. Do you have it on the thumb drive by chance?
I have it on my laptop.
I didn't. I don't know.
Is there another one to do while I get this one?
Yeah, I had it. I think I've got it, but I don't remember seeing Cougar on here. I don't see. No, it's not there. I know I had it on here when I came over, but something happens when I hook up to the system. I don't know where it is. Do you want to swap over your laptop?
Is that easier?
Yeah, just do that. Just do it three different ways at the same time. Sorry about that, John.
I thought it was on there.
Last time I did it,
that's never happened.
Last time
before,
I gave the board one, Stacy had it plugged in the computer, so I got up to present, and it died. You're going to run around looking for a power supply.
Somebody's telling you something.
Somebody's telling you. Well, I should start listening.
Okay, hold on. Now that's going to be it.
So why am I not getting the signal? Oh, it's going to be...
Do you want me to toggle it?
It should just show up.
That's why. I'm going to get it.
Maybe it's doing something. There we go.
There it is.
Okay. So this is the right version. Sorry. Okay, I guess we're ready to go now. This is another real, ought to be fairly short and simple. Basically, there's just a couple little things to do on the Cougar rule. You'll see me again in a few months to do to simplify the Cougar rule is what the board wanted. But in the meantime, there's a couple little things that we needed to deal with right now. The first is just some edits and clarifications in the rule. And then also something that's been proposed is a new depredation permit. And I'll tell you why we're doing that. One of the clarifications, this is a simple one. Marty, our lawyer, was looking through it and he realized that immediate family member hadn't been defined. So we've just put the definition of immediate family member in there in the legalese. Some other things, there's been some changes in how we're dealing with firearms. So there's some clarifications we needed there. For instance, adding this language here, including a muzzle loader or without a magnifying scope, to get things more in line with what we've done in big game and some of the other rules as well. With the Cougar, something that was a little bit different was relative to pursuit. And then this is another, right to bear arms issue kind of thing, where to put that into more of the framework where we're working in the other rules. Someone can still pursue, but if they're legal to carry, they'll still be able to carry. So that was something that was pretty impossible to to deal with law enforcement wise, to have people not carry, although they're just pursuing. So that's pretty simple, just cleaning up some language. This other thing is a little bit more significant. It's a proposal to have a different kind of livestock owner permit for folks that have been dealing with cougar depredations. And the background on it, the way it's set up now, there's currently a 72-hour window. So if someone has a depredation, they get a ewe killed, they've got 72 hours, and themselves or their immediate family member can hunt that cougar and take it out. So there are some restrictions on this about who can do it and when they can work. The complaints have been that removal at that time is typically a lot more difficult. If you've got snow, you can track. Cougars are easier to find, whereas the depredations tend to happen in the spring and summer. So that's been a problem. There's also been some difficulties with wildlife services, who would normally be the first people to call, them not being able to get in, or them not being able to get the cougar, and there's been some frustration there as well. So there's been a call for some more proactive measures where people say, I'm getting lambs or ewes here killed every year. Can't we get in there and remove cougars before I put my lambs on, rather than have to get a few killed and then not be able to get the cougar anyway? There's that idea that then they can at least help themselves and empower these folks that are actually taking the brunt of the damage. And a lot of this came about in some of the discussions in the last round of public meetings. So to deal with this, the division's putting forth this idea to issue depredation permits to take cougar on specified private lands and allotments that have a documented history of ongoing cougar depredation. So just what I was describing right there. The language is that we may issue one or more depredation permits to the affected livestock owner or designee, provided the livestock owner does not receive monetary consideration for the designee. Oh, written by a lawyer, huh? For the opportunity to use the depredation permit. We would determine the legal weapons and methods of take allowed, and we had specified the exact area where these folks would be able to, where this permit would be, would work. So, and then any cougar take, according to this rule, shall be surrendered within 72 hours and remain the property of the state. So that's another key aspect of this. So kind of to summarize what I just said there, is that we had developed this new permit to take cougar on lands that we'd specify. People, it's not just an open the floodgates. People would have to have documented history of depredation, which we'd require wildlife services checking off a series of ewe kills and lamb kills by cougar. We would be able to say what weapons they could use. We'd also talk about what the season is of the permit. And another big thing is that the livestock owner can't make any money on this. They can't sell this. And they can't keep the cougar. So there's really no incentive to take an animal out unless there's damage. They don't get to keep the animal. They don't get to make a trophy or anything like that. That's the idea on it. What we expect is that the producers will then be able to take cougars out the following winter and spring. So if he were to have damage, say, this July, he'd get a permit for maybe January, February, take out cougars before they came onto the allotment. Before the lambs or ewes came on the allotment, and this would empower them to proactively protect their livestock, and this would probably result in some cougars taken that are not responsible for the depredation. Even with the 72 hours, you may or may not get the same animal, but there's a much better percentage. Or if you're taking the dogs off the carcass, there's a real high percentage that you'll get the right cougar. So one of the drawbacks of this is they might be taking out cougars that actually aren't involved in depredation. They just happen to be guilty by being in the wrong spot. And that's the summary of that idea.
Thank you, John. Any questions from members of the RAC?
Can you tell us a little bit more what would constitute a documented history? And then the strikeout says numerous livestock kills, and what would...
Right. So right now we're operating on the chronic being wildlife services documenting several, I think we'd look at there's not a number in there, but it'd have to be, 3 or more. And again, they'd have to be documented. It's that balance, and I mean, we're looking for, this would be a good place to insert some input on this, because the balance, if the bar is so high, that in having wildlife service, they have to get in, they have to get in there soon enough, they have to be able to, positively identify it as cougar. So there's some difficulties there. And we left it a little bit flexible. Only to this, just showing wildlife services documented that it's not just one.
So they would have to have consecutive years of depredation to kind of make this thing stick as far as getting permits in advance to thin the cougars out.
Right. The way it's currently written, you can open up and you can, there's more flexibility if it's over 3 years in a row. There's some question about this one, and I get input about this one. Some people would want chronic to mean several U's in 1 year, and other people would look for that 3 year or 2 year or multiple years. It's kind of, this is what we're here to hear, what the opinions are on this one. And you could, you can kind of take it either way.
John, are you seeing most of the problem with sheep or with cows?
Sheep. So on a typical, 2013, 97 ewes were killed. $51,000 worth of sheep by cougars. So that's a fairly typical year. Yeah.
And these are different livestock owners?
Yes. But I don't have the numbers. I don't know exactly how many owners. I'm just basing it off of our, because they'll get compensated for these.
How many sheep?
97 ewes. And then another 200 or so lambs by cougars.
That's on the state.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And how that much that impacts. I haven't broken it down. I just from experience, typically what happens in these kind of operations, someone will do fine. One person will get hit really hard. Yeah. And if a cougar gets on them, they'll hit one really hard. So somebody might not have a problem. Somebody else, 80 of them could be his or whatever.
Have you gone and seen these cougar kills personally?
Mm-hmm.
That would be good education.
Well, this is for, I have. In the past, I've done a lot of this kind of thing, but no, not these guys.
See what a female with a couple of kittens when she's training them to see what they do.
Sure.
And it's not, this is more of a comment, so maybe I should wait, but it's, out of the, say the 97 ewes, how many were consumed by the lion?
I don't have those numbers. Yeah, they'll surplus kill. They'll do those kinds of things. It's complicated. Yeah, it's complicated.
Any other questions from the rec? Do we have questions or points of clarification from the audience?
Maybe I'm the only one that likes this microphone. I'm Jason Binder, president of the Utah Houndsman Association. I have a couple of questions. I got a half a card full already. So do we have a set number of how many lions that a livestock owner could actually take?
No, so that's, we don't have that set or written in the rule either. I think that would depend on the degree and magnitude of damage and historic. I think, if you look at it and you've got one place, private land, every year for 5 years, that's a different situation than 3 ewes in one season. So I think we'd leave that in that historic lake take. We might be a little more flexible having more than one cougar, and in another situation maybe just one, but I don't have a firm number, but I can't imagine more than a couple cougars on any for any one allotment.
Okay, and are we going to have a Utah wildlife biologist go out and investigate the kills, or is it going to be up to ADC to go and investigate them? I mean, who goes out and helps the landowner determine that? Obviously Larry knows what it looks like. I know what it looks like. Who is going to be responsible for issuing the tags, deeming that it's a chronic problem?
So the process would be Wildlife Services going out. So they would get the damage. They'd call Wildlife Services. They'd document seven in a row. They would call Covey and myself, and then we would decide if that justifies a permit, if there's a need for that, and handle it that way. So, yeah, we'll just rely on Wildlife Services to do the kind of that outside entity to do the objective.
Okay. And are these landowners that are having problems, are they allowing people with tags to actually hunt the ground?
That would be, in the perfect world, I think that would be a really good approach, and I think that's something that this could be incorporated into. For instance, if someone had a problem and Wildlife Services couldn't get to it, or they didn't have dogs. We could have a list, you know, the houndsmen can have a list of folks that we can call on. We can check with the landowner and say, we're going to write a tag to Jason, and then Jason goes and does it. I mean, that'd be great. The trick with it is to make sure anybody that's on this list, it might be, you know, female with kittens. She's got to be taken out. So the difficulty is that whoever gets one of these permits can't pick and choose. You know, they can't wait for a Tom or something. But yeah, I think I don't, there's nothing here excluding people getting along and helping each other out here. This is, the idea is to try to encourage people to do a little more of that.
Okay, and do you have any data? I know ADC keeps their data yearly on how many lions they kill and in what areas do they come from. Do we have any of that data that we can look at as far as areas of the state, or whether it's a statewide problem, whether it's a certain area problem, or have we used any type of that data?
I haven't considered that at this point, but I'll look into that. I'll ask Mike to see what they have in terms of problem folks or allotments and places.
Okay, and if one last question, the landowners that get these tags, are they still going to are they still going to get their allotted money for the animals that the lion killed if they ask ADC not to come back and they come and check out their kill and they say, well, we want to hunt this thing ourselves, and ADC takes their traps and goes away? Are they still going to be allotted their money for the damaged animals?
Yeah, so those are two different processes. So we'll get a list of everybody in the damage claims, and that process is going, and this would be a different process to that. So there's nothing written in it that would prevent that payment from happening.
Okay. And if we change this rule now, isn't it actually part of the management plan?
Yeah, there's that 72-hour rule. There's aspects of this that are in the management plan. And this would modify it, I guess you can say. Depends. If we go with the 3 years, it fits in more or less. If you go then less than a 3 year for a chronic definition, then it'd be a little bit of a tweaking to it.
Okay, and isn't the management group getting together this summer to review the whole plan and open it up and tear it to pieces like the board requested?
Yeah, no, it's that process is going to be a little more simple. We're not going to get the whole, you know, to get the band back together or anything. What we've done is internally looked at where the complications are. Right now, it's keeping the threshold the same. It's just simplifying rather than having this big crazy, I don't know if people remember how you calculate cougar numbers. It's very difficult. So we were just streamlining what's already in the plan, not changing any numbers or any thresholds, just streamlining how it's done. But yeah, no, I mean, that's a good, I mean, it'll be open again for more of this sort of discussion.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions from the audience? Okay, comments from the audience. Jason, you got anything else?
Oh, my turn
again. That's right.
And then you.
Okay, Jason Binder representing the Houndsman of the State. Just want everybody to know, you know, we're not out here against the sheepman or the cattle ranchers or anything like that. The main thing we'd like to see is, rather than bringing this to their axe, I know I set in on the original management plan. This was brought up by one gentleman. It was voted down by the rest of the folks in the management plan, and because of the provisions that we already have, the 72 hours where the landowner or his people that work for him or his next of kin, there was a whole list of brothers, sisters, can already harvest the animal. So when the management group was together, they voted it down, and the main thing we'd like to see is, you know, we are going back into the plan this summer. We're going to refine some things. We'd just like to see a lot more input and a lot more data up front, you know, to see where our chronic problems are and what areas we actually have issues in. And I'd just like to see ADC's thought on this also, because, you know, they're paid professionals. They know what they're doing. They go out there and they target the lion that's actually killed the sheep to the best of their ability. You know, not to say that if I had a fresh sheep killed today, I couldn't take my dogs out there and catch it in 6 feet of snow, but to go on a winter range now where there's no sheep, you don't know what lion you're going to kill. So we'd just like to see a lot more time and effort and use all the avenues we can to come up with the correct plan and get ADC's involvement in on this before we make a decision on this. Thanks for your time.
All right. Thanks, Jason. Other comments from the audience?
Thank you. I'm Garrick Hall, here with the Utah Farm Bureau. We are very much in favor of this proposed change. We're having particularly sheep guys around the state that are seeing ongoing problems year after year. We're not talking about one or two or even three lambs. We're talking, I was talking with the rancher this morning that said he has 30, 40, sometimes 50 head that he loses in a season. And what we've been doing isn't solving the problem. So we're just looking for another tool, another way to try to get to the bottom of this. It's expensive for our guys. You know, they're not looking necessarily for trophy animals. They're going to turn them over to the state. They're happy, in most cases, happy to have hunters come on and hunt those in season, but they're just looking for a way to protect their livestock. This problem has been ongoing year after year. So we encourage you to pass this on to the board. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any other comments from the audience? Okay, seeing none, we'll bring it back to the rec.
That's kind of a question. Does the division have to pay out damage payments on the sheep that are killed by Cooper?
Mm-hmm. So we have, oh, I forgot the number, is it $250,000 the legislature gives us? And so we pay that out up till that amount. And then we end up having to, usually if it goes over, then we'll have to prorate and then give everybody whatever proportional payment, so they might not get a full payment if it goes over, but that's, they do get paid.
Kind of makes sense to me that we try to do a little bit more so we don't have to keep paying out those payments. Okay, that's just my opinion, but it just makes more sense to me to do it that way. And I think another thing that I think would be really good, though, is that we find a way to push that opportunity to the sportsmen. When they're having a problem, try to push that opportunity. Whether or not they keep the animal or not shouldn't matter. They should go out, and if that's an animal that they most likely think is, you know, been involved in that, that they're able to do it. But not just the landowner, but the sportsman too, just like you're talking.
And we do some of that, especially with problem bears and problem cougars. We will have a list of people that have, say, drawn in an area and weren't successful, and we'll have it randomized and super secret and fair, and we will call hunters and have them come in and try to help us out that way. Getting them, but a private landowner or private landowner that can do it themselves, it's not always been, we haven't been able to connect the dots all the time, but that is an option we attempt to do too.
I like what you said about, you know, not ruling out having everybody chip in and help on this. I think that's a good idea. Do we need to include something like that in the motion?
Yeah, I feel awkward. I don't know how to say that. It seemed prudent. I mean, the more guidance and the more you give to the board to hear, you know, I think is definitely helpful. It'd be nice to add all these thoughts into your motion so it's pretty clear that this has been considered and everybody's concerns have been heard and they can put together something decent. So I'd encourage you, of course.
Okay. Thank you. Larry.
Jason brought up a point that I didn't even think about. It was saying a lot of the kills are in the summer months.
Right.
And lion is actually where it's harder to catch in the summer months. With this, if the guy could go after where he knew he was going to have a chronic kill coming up in the spring or the summer, he could actually go out in the winter months where these lions are, and yeah, then they have a better chance of getting the lion that is doing the damages with the snow. And this tool, they could solve some of the problems.
Right.
I should clarify that because maybe I didn't make that as clear as I should have. That's exactly the idea. So the difficulty is, or the concern is that they were too difficult to get in the summer. That's why they wanted the ability to do it in the winter, away from that 72-hour block. And that's exactly the reason.
Will these animals be part of the overall numbers you'd use to determine how many permits that you issue?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The way we're envisioning it right now, it would make sense for them to be part of the quota. So if you have a quota on an area, that's taken out of that unit. That makes the most sense to me. But again, that's...
But you know that as far as I understand it, that male cougars are territorial. You take one out, another one's going to move right in and do the same thing.
Yeah, see, and this is where we get in, the biology of this is kind of interesting because you can, and they've done a fair amount of research out of Oregon on this, where they do find sometimes removing, especially these large males, is like you're saying, you end up with four small, younger, scruffier ones coming in. So you're taking a chance. On the one side, you're removing a cougar from an area where you're going to have sheep. But where you're taking the chance is you could invite four more in. So this is this, and I don't have which is the exact solution. This is why we go through this process to try to mold through it. There isn't. I mean, that's an excellent point.
Okay, but in areas where they're undersubscribed or they're not harvested, you know, an area that's a split, you know, like a limited entry, then harvest objective, you know. I mean, in areas like that have a harvest objective, if they haven't hit the tape, you know, the number of tags, you know, the number of cougars, you should be able to do that. It shouldn't affect what you try to do. Otherwise, as far as how many tags you would issue for the next year, right? So as long as you're not over the harvest objective,
right?
You know, for an area,
mm-hmm.
then it shouldn't affect the numbers for the next year.
Right, it shouldn't. That's the thing. The other, you know, go ahead. Sorry.
Why don't you really consider just on these units that have harvest objectives, whether it's a split unit, you know, limited entry, harvest, or just plain harvest objective, on those units with limited entry, why don't you just leave the harvest objective in place the entire year until you hit that number that you want to take out of that particular unit, instead of closing it off like you do now?
Well, we do. If it's a harvest objective unit, it doesn't. It's going to be open until you hit the number.
Yeah, that's all it is. But if it's limited entry and harvest,
if it's a split, right?
Right. There's a time when that harvest objective season ends.
Right.
Why don't you just let that go until the next year, until you hit that?
I'm operating off the way it was designed and the way it's set up right now.
I'm just saying we seriously ought to think about
it. Sure. Yeah, the splits are in, you know, there's arguments it'd be so much simpler if it was just all harvest objective and a really low female quota. There's so many ways to do this, and then we kind of want it all. So we have limited entry and we have harvest objective and we have the split. So you try to get the idea was to get the best of both worlds with the split. But of course, it's, you know, nothing's perfect.
Yes, Carl.
I'm very comfortable with the 72-hour where we can put a nexus with a kill and then a kill on that. So the current law, I think, is really good. If this were just going to be on private, then I'm pretty comfortable with what's proposed, with kind of a loose definition of numerous and a loose definition of documented history, where we're moving out on to public ground and killing a lion 3, 4, 5 months away from any kill, either after or before, then I don't think we have a a specific enough definition on that. What I'm hearing is lots and lots of questions from this. I trying to come up with a motion in my own mind that I would be comfortable with is difficult. So I'm just expressing that to the board that I think there's lots of questions here, and maybe we ought to take this gentleman's recommendation and look a little further.
Sarah.
So, to follow up on that, because I've been kind of waiting to see who says what, the Forest Service is concerned about the livestock owner receiving the depredation tags for public land. The depredation system is set up for private landowners, correct me if I'm wrong, so that they can take care of predation problems on their private land, to their private, whether it's their fields, their grain, their animals, whatever's happening. So when the livestock owner, they have a permit on public land, they don't own the land, the public owns the land, the state, BLM, Forest Service, we manage the land, how do we justify keeping other public out of receiving some of those depredation tags if they're allowed to go on public land, especially if it's 2-3 months later? A concern that we have is, does it stop here? We start issuing depredation tags for cougar 2-3 months later or prior to a season on public land. Are we going to start doing that for elk and, you know, that are eating alfalfa? Or, I mean, it's a little concern of ours,
yeah,
that it's not equality. The livestock owners have a lot of investment as far as, you know, fence work and everything that they put into that, the management and their livestock, but they don't own the land. So concerned about a little bit of backlash also coming back. Why do these folks get these tags? It's not their land, it's their livestock. How do we, it's a gray zone right there.
Exactly. You know? I mean, I think you guys are really pointing out the issue. There is a lot of gray here. Let me pull out of the current rule what the definition is, and this will help you maybe. For the current rule definition for chronic is that the depredation is occurring on private land. The depredation has occurred in the same area for 3 consecutive years or 4 out of 5 years, and Wildlife Services has attempted to remove the offending animal but has been unsuccessful. So that's what we've been operating on under for chronic, and have avoided those kind of issues right there. So what I would ask is, and hopefully ask all the RACs and the board, is you might want to consider this. Is this, should we do this permit as presented? Do you make it just private land? Do you make it, do you use, you know, not do it the winter or only do the spring or only 2 months before or 2 months after, or do you give that that number, it has to be 3 or something. So those are, it's just, I mean, you guys have identified, I think, where the difficulties are, and it'd be great to have a motion that says, give the rule, work on private and public, define what the allotment is, define where they can work, and only work in January, and it has to be 3 cougars according to chronic, something like that. However you guys, I'm just saying those numbers.
Go ahead.
We definitely agree there's a problem, and these folks are, I mean, the livestock owners, they have an investment out there, so we agree that they should help, if they'd like to, help take care of that problem.
Mm-hmm.
But when it moves into public land, maybe they should not be the only ones, which opens up a whole other problem. So
I can feel some phone calls coming of someone getting fairly, because they have an allotment, they can take a cougar from somebody else's, what they consider their, I don't expect people to like me.
The Tay Cougar thing kind of, I mean, that settles it right down because they don't get to keep it. They don't, you know,
right,
have,
exactly.
have to take out whatever it is that's causing the problem. It looks like more like a group effort to mitigate the problem.
Yeah. I
instead
mean,
of it, instead of like a tag to go kill a cougar.
Right. And that's the idea. But again, like I said, there's a lot of times people perceive all sorts of things, and I've discussed this with folks, and these issues have been brought up, and they say, well, there already is a federal trapper, that there's a system to do this, but then the other side says, well, the system's not working, and then another part of me says, well, it's nice to empower people to solve their own problems, and this guy is getting a financial hit. So that's why we've kind of put together what we're comfortable with so far, and if you've got some, if you can narrow it down for us, we'd appreciate it.
Can't this be resolved with the cougar management plan that's coming up next year? Is that when it is? Summer.
What I think we just see ourselves in, we'll just be having the same discussion 3 months from now or July.
Well, but you're going to have more input from more people on this, right? Who's involved with the cougar management plan? Whose input do you get for that?
Currently, I'm just working with the regions and internally to try to streamline our targeting. It's just one part. We're not revising the whole plan. Oh. It's just the how you calculate permits part. I don't know.
Personally, I don't have a problem with killing one public ground. It is public ground. They're part of the public, too. And if that cougar is coming on private ground and doing it, and then going off on public ground, I don't have a problem with them going on public ground. They're no different than I am. So I don't have a problem with that part.
Neither do we, but we will field phone calls as well. The perception from the public is where you're going to get the backlash.
Yeah, I feel your pain. I understand completely. Yeah, yeah.
Do you have an estimate of how many lives
I suspect it'd be, if I'm writing these things, I'd bet it'd be pretty minimal. 3, 4. I don't have that many people calling with this tremendous, but, you know, the thing, I don't want to get too far down there, because if people realize this is an option, I might get a lot more calls, so I don't want to lock into a number, but I just don't imagine it would be that many. Yeah. And the difficulty is that the real balance is, you know, one option is just to open up as a harvest objective and just try to take every cougar off of a whole unit, whereas that actually impacts the biology, whereas one or two cougars from a specific area within a unit is not impacting the biology, but might be helping a guy out. So, but then it depends how it's perceived on the outside. I'm sorry I'm making this more complicated. I should have just... Potentially.
That sounds fairly specific. You know, it's not, you know, and I don't know how many, if you get a million calls of people that are claiming, but the problems still have to be documented. They have to be ongoing. I mean, it's fairly specific criteria for allowing you to remove a cougar. Yeah. I think it's fine to let the guys do something about it on their own. Mm-hmm. And I think they might anyway.
Yeah. And ideally, we'd set up a process where we can use this and say, call up the houndsmen. They can help, you know, we can figure something out. Whether or not I could pull it off, I don't know.
Okay.
But you can do that now.
Yeah, largely.
Yeah, that is a tied to a kill, which is going to be an effective way of getting the one that did the kill.
Exactly.
4 months later, that's
Yeah. Right. There are options now. Again, the difficulty is, but it's still, if you know, you don't get on there, don't get hounds, or don't get the wildlife services guy in there right at the right time, it's going to be easier to remove cougars during the winter than during the summer.
I think the deer would like it.
I'll throw out a motion.
Okay.
The motion will be that we accept it as presented on private ground and that we delay the public ground until the cougar management plan is evaluated more.
Okay, I have a motion that we accept the proposal has been presented with exception of public ground, that it'd be that way on private ground, but that they would table that activity on public ground until it had been discussed further. Is that what you meant to say? Do I have a second? I have a second from Matt. Any discussion on the motion? Okay, all in favor? All opposed? Okay, motion dies.
I'd like to make a proposal to accept the division's recommendation as presented.
Proposal made by Richard, seconded by Larry. Any discussion on the motion? Okay, all in favor? All opposed? Motion dies.
Make your motion again.
Seems like if this actually is a very isolated circumstance, that it's not much different than what they've got going. You know, the wildlife services are pretty sharp at what they do, and it seems like they could possibly tell which cougars are there. I mean, if you've chased very many lions, you can tell tracks. And there's a lot of times you can know which one you're after, but I don't know. I'll entertain a motion. What?
Just another explanation is the kill may occur 50 miles from where this lion's killed. And so, I mean, if it's easier to catch in the winter, that deer may come off, have killed this sheep up on the mountain and comes down to hunt deer and runs into the sheep again. And so I don't think there's a way under this to identify, even come close to the specific lion. And under the current law, I mean, 72 hours, I think they do a good job of rounding up people. I've gotten a call to go kill and killing specific lions that are doing it. I just still have difficulty killing lions up on public ground 4 months after they may have lost a sheep. On public ground or private ground, I have no difficulty, but I don't know if that changes anybody's vote.
My question is, do you know a cougar that would turn down a sheep to eat? I don't think any of them would, given the right spot, the opportunity. So, you know, I'm not really on the side of the cougar. Okay, I'm more on the side of the livestock owner, okay, and the difficulty that becomes. And that's like, with Larry, I think that a lot of them don't even ever report it. I think there's a whole lot more that are killed that are never reported, and those guys just absorb that loss. And I think we need to be a little more understanding and a little more helpful to those guys that are trying to make a living in that business.
I don't want anybody to assume that I'm against those guys, but I would really rather put this in a sportsman's hand to kill it at somewhere else rather than a landowner. I mean, I appreciate it on their own ground to do that, but I would rather have that harvest in a sportsman than a landowner's grandson or son. So that's why I just think it needs to be talked more on their own ground, take them out. On public ground, we need to talk about it a little more.
So are you saying that if there's an area where there's specific problems are occurring yearly, that they should just increase the harvest objective in that specific area and then allow the sportsmen to do it?
If we're talking three-year chronic stuff, yeah. Let's give more tags, or let's open it up to a harvest objective and take some more out. But if we're looking at this and really looking at three-year chronic, we ought to be able to say, we got a problem. and let's put some more hunters out there, and then handle it that way rather than this way.
Can I ask just one more question?
You bet.
You're gonna look at each case separately. You're not gonna allow a 50-mile radius, right, from where they lost the animal on public land. It's gonna be smaller. Or is it
going to
be bigger? Do you know? Do you have an idea?
Yeah, it'd be on private land, it's easier because, you know, it'll be their land. If it's allotments, then it would be allotment. We'd have to work with you guys to outline the allotment. Right now, another theoretical comes up. What if they track the cougar on the allotment and then it runs off, which it will do? Mm-hmm. And then the way we're envisioning doing that at this point is, you know, there's got to be clear evidence that they started within and on land, you know, within the identified area. So this permit would say you will work on this person's land and here's the boundary for it, and that's it.
So it would be the entire land?
Mm-hmm. Unless there's some section of it that made sense, that they're only in this one part during July, and that's where they're having the problem, then we just do that part of it, presumably.
Case by case,
completely case by case, yeah.
I'll entertain a motion. But I mean, keeping track of details enough to form it so it can pass. Have they identified any of those, like you said you'd be working with, like the public land people, like if they're having depredation problems on their allotment, that they'd be, you know, that's where they'd target the lion? I mean, it wouldn't just be like on that unit, right?
Can you restate?
Cougar comes down and snarfs a bunch of sheep on a specific allotment where a guy has his sheep.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then the problem, you know, where they range him and where they eat him, and then where the lion may go. You know, got a little of that going on. But are you going to try and restrict him to the area where the problem was?
Yes. So that's the idea. We're not going to say you got to start in the same field.
Right.
It'd be your private land, or if you guys want it, or the allotment. The where we're going now, it's more on that private land, and I'd tell you only work on this private land. But then we'd outline what the area was that they'd work in. It was just what we're talking about there. It'd be that allotment, and we'd work with the Forest Service to figure out what those boundaries were.
Okay.
And this wouldn't coincide with any other winter?
Yeah, so it'd get them out during the prime hunting season. Yes.
I used to be in the sheep business, and I had this chronic problem every year. We'd move off to the desert, we'd go up on our lambing range, and we'd move up on Savy Mountain. And as soon as we moved on Savy Mountain, we knew we were going to have a lion kill. And so we'd wildlife services out there, and we tried to kill the lion, and that's a harder area to hunt in the cedars, and a lot of times we wouldn't get that lion. So we'd get tired of getting our sheep killed out on Sabie Mountain, so we'd run up to Kern Creek Mountain, and we knew within a week when we got to Kern Creek Mountain, we were going to have lion kills. And on that particular area, it was easy to trap lions in that area, so we would trap them. But that was something that would happen every year, starting from about 1984. Before 1984, I can't remember a lion kill. I never heard my dad talk about it. But through the 80s, the lions expanded. Early 90s, Wildlife Services took out a bunch of lions. That's when they all went into the towns, and they demolished the lions. And that's when all the houndsmen came about. Everybody bought a dog and thought they was a houndsman, and they'd go chase a lion. And since then, they've kind of maintained the lions, but they still have these chronic problems. They're going to go, these areas, the lions are going to, since sheep get there, you know, they know where the sheep are going to be.
Yeah.
And most of the time it's going to be the wildlife services guy that goes and gets the lion within 72 hours. But a lot of times, sometimes they can't. But the landowner is not going to get any reward for this other than saving his livestock. He can't sell the tag. He can't keep the hide. I have multiple lions killed on my private property. I'd love to have a lion hide hanging on my wall, but I couldn't keep a hide. And these problems are going to continue on Forest Service, BLM, and private. So there's my example of it.
Thank you. So there's not a lot of sportsman incentive.
There's no incentive to kill these lions because nobody gets to reap the benefits of it.
Okay.
Except for saving the livestock.
Okay. Thank you. I'd be like
Larry,
to.
Do you think it was the same lion that would follow you over to Current Creek, or a,
no?
A different. I mean, because if you're not getting it then, the same guy, different guy, and.
We had one example that was a tom that we would have a kill on Current Creek Mountain, and that's not Current Creek, it's Current Creek Mountain, it's over by Soldier Creek. And then Bashers would have a kill a week to 10 later over in Red Creek. And then a week to 10 later, days later, we'd have a kill. They finally killed the lion in, this went on for 2 to 3 years, and they finally killed the lion in Little Red Creek. And our killing stopped. If we could have took that lion out between those two areas years before, we would have saved thousands of dollars. And we didn't have we didn't get paid back then like the producers get paid now. We absorbed our own losses.
I want to form that into a motion.
I make motion as presented, but we've already shut that one down.
Okay. I second it.
Okay, we've got a motion made by Larry, seconded by Richard. Any question or discussion on the motion?
This is a motion that's already been made.
What's the motion?
It's already been
made. That it's, yes.
All right.
Okay. Do you want to modify that a little bit?
Leave it.
Can you modify it a caveat where it's reviewed after 2 years? I also want to see it somehow, the motion, talk about sportsmen being a priority in this.
Open it up to sportsmen.
Open it up, yeah.
Because there's probably some of those guys don't want to do that. They would rather call somebody that's got a house and
the average landowner doesn't own hounds. Yeah. He wants someone that can go in there to get the job done. And that's why I say most of the time it's going to be Wildlife Services doing this.
So issue the tag to the livestock owner allow them to go outside of the immediate family?
What incentive would it give these guys if they can't keep the line?
Practice, run the hounds. I mean, I don't know, is there an incentive? I mean, there is practice, it's more time out, run your hounds.
They're doing it anyway.
The average houndsman is probably not going to go out and just kill a lion and take him out of that area rather than kill him.
And I see a problem in actually calling a houndsman because a houndsman will chase the lion off. So, seriously, that's what would happen. Don't you think, Jason? I've seen that too.
And that basically just. that basically gives the average houndsman a black eye from the, what we've tried to prevent. You know, for the longest time, everybody thought houndsmen were just out to kill it. You know, so if I send my buddy Bill over to Larry Sheep and he just knocks his lion out of the tree just because it's on, Bill's probably going to get beat up when he gets back to town.
One question, when is this review supposed to happen? Next year?
Well, and this is where there's some confusion. There isn't really, this plan goes until, 2021. There isn't a date, 2021. There isn't a date for a review of this whole plan that's in the current version of it. Well, as the board, they're frustrated trying to follow the permitting process, so they asked to simplify that. So that's what we've been working on, just simplifying that. It's just,
no set date, it's just there's 2020.
Just simplify, exactly. But as far as reviewing and doing the whole plan over, putting a committee together like you guys are talking about, that wasn't that's not on the cards at this point, unless someone says, let's put everything together and redo this whole thing, which is frustrating. But
can I?
Sorry?
It's not the direction that we've received from our administration.
Right. One thing, maybe I can help you guys out, because in your packet, I think there's just a couple little issues as I read through what the changes are that might help you guys put some motions together. Could I help?
Please, David.
So the first one is, what this just adds is this number four, which is division may issue depredation permits to take cougar on a specified private lands and public grazing allotments with a chronic depredation situation where numerous livestock have been killed by cougar. And that's really the guts of it. And from what I've heard the discussion, you guys have to agree on what numerous means and private and public. And other than that, I mean, it's really just that statement.
Same thing.
Yeah, and then the other thing is adding in, you know, you could probably do something where I'd probably do this informally, but you could, you know, I don't know, codify it a little more by saying that we would work with the houndsman to create a list of people, because the next sentence says, issue one or more depredation permits to the affected livestock owner or a designee. So this designee could be from a pool of sportsmen that are willing to remove a cougar. And so I guess that's the big thing, is just sorting out private, public, what numerous means, and whether to use a pool as the designees.
What does numerous mean to you, Larry?
Numerous? Say a female's training her kittens. Well, when I was in the sheep business, I sold my sheep in '93. It got to the point when I had a coyote kill that didn't bother me, because when a lion comes in, it doesn't kill just one. Very seldom. Maybe, you know, there are cases. It's a cat playing with a bunch of mice. They'll go in and knock down 20 or 30 lambs. Within, you know, and they may drag one off to eat, but so numerous to me is if they kill one, that's, you know, that's good. But when they go in and kill 20 or 30, and you know, that's not unusual. But this number of 97 ewes and 200 lambs, I think that, I don't know, that seems quite low to me. Does that take into account all the wildlife services?
Those are the depredation claims.
Depredation claims. That's not.
So they're reporting. Reporting.
You know, it's too bad we don't have somebody from wildlife services that could say, you know, state how many they. But one night, 20 lambs isn't unusual for a lion to kill. And you know, 20 lambs. That's $2,000. On today's market, out of the producer's pocket. So,
what if I made a motion to accept as presented with one change to define numerous as at least 10 animals taken.
That would be fine.
That's my motion.
Let me add one or discuss one other comment. I'm okay with moving it out to public if it's within like 4 weeks of when the sheep are going to be there, or 4 weeks after the sheep have left, you know, so that there is something to tie it to actual possibility or a kill. And so, I mean, I'm okay with moving it out on the public if the harvest, you've got a chronic problem on public, you're going to move the sheep on in June, and they go in May and kill it. Then I'm okay with that. But just to you think it's going to kill one in June, and so we're going to kill it in January when it's the easiest, I still have some problem with
that. That actually makes sense to me, too. Not all winter long prior to the livestock moving on to the...
So I'll make that substantive motion that it can go on to public, but it has to be 4 weeks, a month prior to the sheep getting on the allotment. They could get this chronic tag, fit all those definitions, and they could kill it a month, 4 weeks before they bring the sheep up on it.
So you're within a month?
Yeah.
You okay with that?
Yes.
4 weeks after.
So you got a month either side, right? Is that what you said?
I'm okay with a month either side.
Is that agreeable to you?
That's the motion I'll make, yes.
Okay, will one of you restate the motion, please?
It'll be the first motion, which will be accepted as it is, with the addition that on public ground, the permit can be issued, but the harvest has to occur within a month of the sheep getting on the allotment or a month of them leaving the allotment.
Okay. Motion has been made. Is there a second?
Can I ask for clarification?
You can.
That's on public land only?
Yeah, on public land. On private, it can go just as is.
Okay.
Okay, so the motion is that to accept the proposal as it's been presented, with the exception or the amendment that if it's on public land, that it would be within a month either side of the animals that are being depredated on being there. Something like that.
Not with 10 animals as numerous or anything.
Wouldn't it mess with numerous? Okay. All right, motion has been made. Is there a second? Matt. Motion has been made and seconded by Matt. All in favor? Six in favor, all against? One against? Motion passes. Our next item. Are you ready? We have the R657-27 licensed agent procedure rule and amendments, and we have Phil Gray, the business analyst, here to present that to us. Oh, that's Phil. I'm sorry.
My first RAC meeting that I present at, and I'm late. I apologize.
Okay.
I'll try to make mine a little less controversial than John's. Okay, my name is Phil Graham, the business analyst with the division. I'm going to be presenting some changes to 657-27, specifically dealing with licensed agents, how we work with them. The proposed changes we have, a few minor housekeeping edits and corrections. We were asking to provide the division authority to be able to require an automated clearinghouse process when collecting monies from agents. The wording that we put in the rule is that we may require this, not that we will require it, so we do have some latitude in dealing with agents that may not be able to use the electronic payment method. We're asking the ability to require all agents to allow access to the Utah.gov domain. So anytime a customer that's in their store needs to get to the division's website to look up a hunt map, a hunt table, season dates, stocking reports, anything like that, they'll be able to from any place that sells fishing licenses, hunting licenses. We've actually gotten this request from a lot of the big retail corporations that lock down what their employees can get access to on their computers in their stores. They're trying to babysit their employees, but if they want to do business with us, they have to have access to all of that information, especially now that we have a number of guidebooks that are solely online. Hunt maps are solely online. That's the only resource that we have available to those customers in those places. We like to remove some language that allows the division to supply the computer equipment for new agents. When this rule was first written, everybody is still getting on board with the internet and computers. We thought it would be a good incentive to get agents if we're able to provide them the equipment. Computer equipment has come down in price so greatly. It's just a cost of doing business now. I can't imagine anybody running a business without being able to buy a computer. If they want to sell fishing licenses, hunting licenses with the state, they have to do it online. They have to have a computer. It's an investment they're going to have to make on their own. The division can no longer afford to do it. However, we will still be providing the first printer. Any subsequent printer after that, if it needs replaced, upgraded, whatever, it's on the agent. And we'd like to reduce the amount of time that agents are required to retain the audit copies of a license that they sell. So currently, if you can see up here, on the left we have a license. This is what our licenses have looked like for years. That bottom portion, it has all of your name, address, height, weight, sex, birthday, everything that somebody needs to steal your identity. This has been sitting on a shelf in a store all across the state. We've been requiring agents to keep this for a year. And it's just a matter of time before this ends up in a dumpster or some ticked off employee decides to take it home with them, sell it on the internet. So what we've done is we've scaled it down. On the right, you'll see this is the new template for the license. That bottom portion, it's no longer going to have everybody's personal private information on it. It's going to have the license type and the license code and the date it was sold. That way the agents can look at it at the end of the day and say, okay, I know this combination went out the door. I have $30 in the register. We're reconciled. As soon as they reconcile it, whatever the agents decide, how long they decide it takes to do that, we're fine with that. Once they get to that point, they can destroy the agent copy as already in per rule by either burning it, shredding it, or sending it back to the division. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Phil about the license business? I think it's a good idea pulling the personal info off there.
I thought that's so too. 500,000 licenses a year, especially and the majority of those are sitting in the store somewhere.
How it's getting it's now.
Scary.
You have a comment?
In today's world, I think you're right. Probably everybody's got a computer. But I know a lot of, sell a lot of licenses, you know, in rural Utah. Do you have a feel for how many people are not on a computer system nowadays, small businesses and that sort of thing? There might be license agents that...
None.
...that would be impacted by this?
It's none.
Okay.
If you're selling licenses for the state, if you're a license agent, you have to have a computer. Okay. It's only done online.
Gotcha. Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Any other questions from the rack?
This may be an obvious question, but what is the benefit? Is the benefit just to get people into the store to buy a license? I mean, what?
Yes.
What is the license dealer getting out of selling?
By law, by statute, a license agent is entitled to. I got to remember this right. It's 50 cents for any license under $10, 5% of the license fee over $10. So they do get money out of it. Not a huge chunk. We've even had stores like Walmart that say, can we just donate it back? It's not even worth our time. I mean, 3/4 of all the licenses in the state go through a Walmart, but that's a drop in the bucket for the guys back in Arkansas, a few $100,000 a year they don't care about. They'd rather give it back. But there is a financial incentive for them to be an agent, yes. But the biggest incentive is to get them in the store buying bait, tackle, guns, ammo, that kind of stuff. And make it really easy. Everybody's within 20 miles of a Walmart.
What was that?
Not quite everybody.
Okay, most everybody.
What's wrong with the bird?
Is he a jokester or what?
Any other questions from the rack? Okay. Question?
No, I was going to make a motion, but it's too soon.
Yes. Okay, also, we'd like to recognize Calvin Crandall, who wandered in. He's one of our wildlife board members. We appreciate his attendance here tonight. Any questions from the audience about the license change? Any comments from the audience about the license change? All right, we'll bring it back to the rack to entertain a motion. Danny.
Yeah, because I voted no the last time around, I'd like to make the motion that we accept the proposal as proposed.
Okay, motion's been made by Danny to accept the proposal as presented. Is there a second? Okay. It's been motioned and seconded. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously.
Thank you.
Our next item is an action item as well. It's about our 657-60 aquatic invasive species rule and amendments. We have Jordan Nielsen, the AIS coordinator here, that's going to make the presentation. Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize, likewise, for being late. I left the office 2 hours before this, anticipating a bad commute, but what I didn't anticipate was 2.5 hours and taking my life in my hands to get here. So please excuse me for being late. We're revisiting a few things in our aquatic invasive species interdiction rule again. I've been working with the Western Regional Panel of the Aquatic Nuisance Species Task Force, which is a federally mandated organization for managing invasive species across the country. I've been working with the Western Regional Panel to build some consensus among the Western states so that we're all doing things the same way. This is a need that's been identified in the past so that a boater can go from Utah to Idaho or Wyoming or Nevada and expect a similar result from their aquatic invasive species program. One of the first things, the low-hanging fruit, if you will, that we decided to tackle was how we are classifying water bodies that have quagga or zebra mussels in them. So under the current classification, we use a kind of a pseudo-classification called inconclusive, which means we don't quite have enough data to prove that we have quagga or zebra mussels. We're going to maintain that, but it'll change just a little bit under the new system. In rule and in law, currently, we are allowed to classify something as detected or suspected, as lumped into one, or infested if it has a Dreissena mussel in it. Under the new system, the way that the Western states want to do this, we'll break detected and suspected up and give them different definitions and continue to use the infested definition, but modify what we're currently using, which is in rule or in code, it says infested is any water that contains a Dreissena mussel. Anything under law right now. So let's start with inconclusive. This definition stays basically the same. It indicates that we find something suspicious. We find what looks like a Dreissena veliger shell, but we can't prove it. We don't have a second method to prove what it is. One example of that you guys may have heard about is Jordanelle Reservoir. We did find some what appear to be shells there this summer. On two different occasions, no DNA. We can't prove that they're Dreissena mussels. These are microscopic. We're talking about tiny fractions of an inch. We use cross-polarized light microscopy to identify these, so it's very easy to make mistakes, and that's why we use two different methods. And that will remain the same. The next classification up, one that will actually be written into rule, currently we call it detected. under the new system, we will call it suspect or suspected. What it means is we pull one sample from a water body with our nets when we filter the water. We visually observe a mussel in the water body, adult or veliger, and then we send it to a lab to have DNA analysis done to prove that it is actually a Dreissena mussel. An example of this that we discussed with the Western States is Sand Hollow Reservoir. We found one adult live quagga mussel in 2010. We have never been able to identify another mussel in that reservoir since. That would end up falling under the suspect classification, and under rule would be under the director's order for declassifying. Currently, a detected classification requires 5 years of negative sampling in the water body to remove it from that list. Under the new system, it will require 3 years. Under the old system, we step down from detected to inconclusive. Under the new system, there will be no step down. It will remain as a suspect water until it has sampled for 3 years consecutively with no positive results of Dreissena mussels, and then we'll completely remove the declassification. The next classification, there isn't currently one at this level. We're adding in detected here, which means we collect two consecutive samples where we visually observe mussels and we confirm it with DNA using PCR techniques. When we do that DNA verification, they go to separate labs. So we have two independent labs that verify it because it's easy to get a false positive with this. An example of a water body that would fall under this classification is Lake Powell late last year when we pulled multiple samples from there that had quagga mussel veligers, and they were verified with DNA. So Lake Powell at the end of 2012, under the new system, would be called detected. The final classification is infested. Currently, infested means any water body that has a Dreissena mussel in it. So it could be a veliger, an adult, could be a single individual, or it could be multiple. Under the new system, we are saying that we want to find multiple age classes multiple times of attached mussels, so adult mussels. An example of this would be Lake Powell. What we found this year, we've on multiple occasions, we've gone out and sampled and found adult Dreissena mussels attached to boats and docks and canyon walls. Under the old system, it would take 8 years to declassify this, stepping down from one classification to the next. Under the new system, it would take 7, and it would remain as infested for 7 years when it would be removed from the list. There is a light at the end of the tunnel if a water body receives a classification as a mussel-affected water body. Under the new system, inconclusive remains with that water body for 1 year, just as a recap. We sample heavily during that 1 year to make sure that we don't have something or we actually do have something. Suspect would remain with that water body for 3 years. Detected for 5 and infested for 7. Now the countdown for this doesn't start with the classification. It starts with the first negative sample. So, for example, Lake Powell, if we are still currently finding Dreissena mussels in Lake Powell, at some point in the future, if we happen to pull a sample that is negative, the countdown would start there for 7 years. If at any point after that we pull another sample that has quagga or zebra mussels in it, the countdown would start over. However, we are making concessions in this rule change for water conservancy districts or water companies that can act immediately with a control plan to eradicate mussels completely. An example of some place that might be able to do this would be Grantsville Reservoir out by Twilla. They could easily drain their reservoir, treat the walls of the reservoir for the mussels, kill everything, and then refill it. In that case, it would probably go under a director's order to evaluate the water for 3 years to make sure that there is no mussels in the reservoir. What this classification system does for water bodies currently classified in Utah, Lake Powell would retain its infested classification as it is now. Red Fleet Reservoir has gone 5 years with negative testing. We have not found Dreissena mussels since 2008 there, so we would remove all classifications. It would be removed from our blacklist, if you will. Electric Lake, the same thing. It's gone 5 years. We would remove that from our list. And Sand Hollow would be reclassified as a suspect water rather than an infested water. And it would go under the director of the Division of Wildlife's designation after that. The hope is with this that it has also gone for 3 years without a verified sample, and we could remove it from a list as well. Thank you.
Any questions from the rack? Richard.
Maybe you've already answered this, and maybe we've done this before, but is there any way to get rid of these mussels other than what you explained in the groundsville?
Unless you can completely drain and dry a reservoir, currently there's no practical way of doing it. There are chemicals that will kill them, and technology is developing with attenuated bacteria strains to be able to kill them, but it's not at a level where we could treat a reservoir at this point.
Okay, thanks.
So Lake Powell's going to be contaminated for a really long time.
That appears to be the case. Nothing that we have in the United States or that we want to introduce to the United States. I've also been asked if people can eat them, and the answer to that is you can eat anything once. So I don't recommend it. They bioaccumulate a lot of toxins.
Any other questions from the rack? Any questions from the audience? Yes. State your name, please, when you get to the mic.
Craig Bonham from Draper, Utah. I've attended these RAC meetings, except you start holding them during hunting season, so I haven't been here. And then I grew a beard in the meantime since I've been here. But the question I have is, these mussels, are they found only in lakes or are they found in rivers?
Currently, we're only finding them in lakes. They tend to inhabit places where the water moves past them 1 meter a second or less. Faster than that, they have trouble attaching. And so right now, we're not finding them in rivers.
That's good. I noticed at a lot of places they're requiring boats to stop and be checked and everything. Is that ever going to be a possibility with float tubes or pontoon boats or things like that?
On rivers?
Just at these stops?
Currently, the way it gets a little complicated as to what our authority is for stopping people. Currently, we can stop people at ports of entry. And this last summer, we ran a check station at the port of entry coming in from the south on I-15 at Bloomington. And any watercraft was required to stop. If they didn't, we had an officer there that would chase them down and talk to them. So yes. We started at the port of entry. There are some plans to do some voluntary checkpoints at different locations because we don't have the authority to make it mandatory anywhere but at checkpoints. And so we're gonna work on a model like that and see if it works, see if people will voluntarily stop. Who knows? That's kind of up in the air, but.
I just have two questions just in general for my education. Does Utah require or allow felt sold waders anymore?
Currently, there's no restriction on felt sold waders. Personally, I would love to see it, But that is something that has to go through the state legislature to make a law.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Even Alaska is not allowing those anymore.
Yeah, and I just received a report that North Dakota just passed a law to ban felt sole waders as well.
And then,
we talked about it a few years ago, about banning it. We were just waiting for a lot of other companies to come up with some better solutions for banning foods that were feltless. And we were actually starting to see that now. So.
Then one last question. I haven't heard anything about whirling disease for a while. It used to be a real big deal, but you don't hear much about that. How's it doing?
It's still a big deal, and whirling disease is doing well, unfortunately.
Really?
And that's probably why we don't hear so much about it, because it's so ubiquitous at this point.
Thanks.
Any other questions from the audience? Comments from the audience? Okay, we'll bring it back to the rack for a motion. Go ahead.
To approve as presented.
Okay, motion's been made to approve the plan as presented, or the proposal as presented. Is there a second? Matt seconds it. All in favor? Motion passes unanimously. I think that's it, isn't it? I'd like to thank you guys for coming to RAC meeting tonight. I appreciate your interest and awareness and your desire to make a difference. There's a board meeting this Thursday in Salt Lake. If you would like to attend, you'll have opportunities there as well if you'd like. It'll be on last month's business. It's the Bucks and Bulls. It's once in a lifetime. It's the stuff we talked about at last RAC meeting. Thank you. Meeting adjourned.
Nice work.
The gavel.
Never had that. Yeah, no.
That was an interesting one. I felt like I was playing bridge.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
The snow fell.
Then I know who I can call.
That's fine. I'm getting myself. 435.